Hello and welcome to the Lane Cassette Podcast. Today I'll be covering Friday the 13th, Part 2. After the success of Friday the 13th, Paramount decided they needed a sequel, and fast. Sean Cunningham wasn't sure how to go about it because Mrs. Voorhees was dead, and the end sequence of the first one where Jason jumped out of the lake was meant to be a dream. Victor Miller and Tom Savini were also against the idea of a sequel that would make Jason the killer. One of Cunningham's protégés, Steve Miner, took over director duties. Ron Kurz, the uncredited douche writer from the first one, wrote the script. Frank Mancuso Jr., son of Paramount head Frank Mancuso Sr., joined the production fresh out of college as an associate producer. Another renowned makeup effects guru, Stan Winston, was originally signed on to handle those duties but had to drop out due to scheduling conflicts, and Carl Fullerton took his spot. Production started in September 1980, about 4 months after the first Friday the 13th theatrical release. Adrian King returned, albeit in a much smaller role. There are several versions as to why her role was so reduced. One is that the studio didn't want to pay her what she was asking. The second is that she had a stalker. The story has been verified, of course, and her stalker actually befriended her. She obviously had no idea this man was her stalker, and she said it ended with him having a gun pointed at her head. However, she was able to talk him down. Apparently, when he befriended her, she would feed him information about the stalker, about himself, and quite a scary situation. Our new cast consists of Amy Steele as Ginny, John Fury as Paul, Stu Charno is Ted, Lauren Marie Taylor plays Vicky, Marta Kober is Sandra, Tom McBride is Mark, Bill Randolph is Jeff, Kristen Baker is Terry, Russell Todd is Scott, Walt Gourney returns as Crazy Ralph, Jack Marks is Deputy Winslow, Cliff Cundy is Max, Betsy Palmer cameos as Mrs. Voorhees, and Steve Daskowitz and Warrington Gillette both play Jason Voorhees. Harry Manfredini once again handled the music. Peter Stein was a cinematographer. The movie was mostly shot at Camp Kenmont in Connecticut, which is where the cast and crew stayed during the filming. They actually stayed at the camp. The bar scenes were filmed at Lake Warmaming Casino, which burned down about a year or so after Friday the 13th Part 2 was released. Friday the 13th Part 2 was released May 1st, 1981, and grossed over $21 million on a $1.2 million budget. It was down considerably from the first one, but it was still a major success by making 20 times its budget, and Paramount considered it a major success as well. We open up the movie on a dark street, and we see a kid splashing in a puddle singing the Itsy Bitsy Spider. Then the kid's mother calls him in, and as he exits the frame, we see someone's legs as they walk. We get little bits of the Friday score. We see Alice sleeping in bed having a bit of a nightmare, and in her nightmare we see highlights of the end of the last movie of her encounters with Mrs. Voorhees. This goes on forever, as we see the end of the last movie with cuts of her having her nightmare. She finally wakes up and gets a call from her mother. It seems Mommy Dearest is worried about her, and Alice promises to call her in the morning and hangs up. It seems she is still drawing as some of her artwork is out in the kitchen. Alice hits the shower and emerges when she gets a phone call, but no one is on the line when she picks up. She is a bit freaked out and walks around her apartment armed with an ice pick. A cat jumps through the window and scares the fuck out of her. She opens the fridge to get some cat food and is frightened to see Mrs. Voorhees' decapitated head in it. She screams and backs up right into our killer, who puts the ice pick through her temple, and we get the opening credits. Now, it's important to note here that this opening sequence takes place 2 months after the events of the first movie. And Alice's hair is considerably longer than the first, so don't buy that bullshit. And after our opening credits, we jump 5 years into the future. So 2025. Actually, it's originally was supposed to be 1985, but I think they retconned a bit so that the first Friday actually takes place in 79, so I'm guessing this would be 84. We follow a young couple who park at a gas station and run to a nearby phone booth while Crazy Ralph watches on. And he eventually comes over and warns them like the counselors before. He fucks off, and our dollar store Kevin Bacon continues on with his phone call. While all of this is going on, a tow truck hooks this dude's truck up. They notice the truck pulling away and run after him. The guy stops around the corner where the dude they were on the phone with, Ted, had the tow truck driver hook it up as a joke. Tow truck driver lets it down, and the three continue to the camp having a jolly old time as they drive. They pull over to move a log out of the way, and Sandra finds a Camp Crystal Lake sign, and she asks about it. Our jokester Ted tells her she doesn't want to know, even though she clearly fucking asked, you dickhead. And for the record, our Kevin Bacon discount dude is Jeff, and Sandra's his girlfriend. We get a POV shot of someone watching them as they take back off down the road. We cut to the camp and meet our new batch of future victims and the man in charge, Paul. This new camp is Packinac, and it's a training center for counselors. We see Paul's girl arrive, and good old Crazy Ralph isn't far behind. Paul pulls Ginny, his woman, into his office to bitch about her being late, and she pretty much just blows it off. Ginny's got some sass. Paul continues on with his speech after this, and my favorite piece of dialogue is here when he tells women to keep clean during their menstrual cycle. As if they didn't already know that, you fucking tool. We do establish here that Jenny's car is a piece of shit. That's going to be important later. Later that night, Paul tells his trainees the story of Jason Voorhees and how he's allegedly still out there and mentions Alice's disappearance. I guess they never found her body. He tells them they are the first group to go back to the lake since the events of the first movie. His story gets intense, and Ted jumps out dressed like, I don't know, a fucking caveman with a spear. Looks like he's wearing like a Fred Flintstone type garb. He has a laugh and tells them Jason is dead and so is his mother, and he doesn't want to hear another word about it, and that Camp Crystal Lake is definitely off limits. Ginny seems a bit shaken by the whole story. Later on, our teens socialize in the main cabin while someone watches them from outside. Sandra tells Jeff she wants to go check out Camp Blood. Jeff, of course, being sane, refuses. While Ginny prepares for bed, we see someone sneaking around her cabin. She hears a knock and goes outside to find no one. Paul snuck inside her cabin and scares the shit out of her. Ginny and Paul make out while Crazy Ralph watches, no doubt trying to get an erection, you fucking crazy perv. Someone is on the other side of the tree he is leaning on and uses a piece of barbed wire to kill and strangle the old bastard. We cut to the next morning. Our counselors are doing some physical fitness, I guess. Running races or laps, whatever, down the road, the dirt road that leads to the camp. Paul also shows them some trails while we get Jason's POV shot. Muffin, a little dog belonging to one of the counselors, runs up to Jason's feet, and we immediately cut to hot dogs being cooked on a grill, having a little picnic a packinac. Later on, the group goes swimming, and Sandra insists to Jeff that they go to Camp Blood. Again, he refuses, but finally gives in. As Jeff and Sandra walk, we see someone step from behind a tree and watch them step over a useless no trespassing sign with a barbed wire fence. They come upon what looks to be a dead, mangled dog and are caught by a deputy. Back in Paul's office, the deputy bitches to Paul about them, but Paul doesn't seem to give a fuck, especially when the deputy threatens him. Paul dismisses Jeff and Sandra to the deputy's dismay. Basically, he wants to throw the book at them for a little bit of trespassing. I mean, what the fuck? Later on, as the deputy drives away from the camp, he sees someone running through the woods, and he runs after them. Fun fact about this scene, the actor stated in the Crystal Lake Memories documentary that he had never driven a car before or since the scene. They had to give him lessons. Eventually, Deputy Dickweed comes upon a shack in the woods and goes in to investigate. It's a real shithole, and it looks like it was built by a third grader. He opens a door to another room and is stunned by what he sees. We don't see what it is, and he doesn't see anything ever again because he gets a claw end of a hammer to the back of the head. Thanks for coming, now get the fuck out. Bye. At supper that evening, Paul promises a last night on the town, but makes Jeff and Sandra stay home. A few other volunteers stay behind as well. Mark, who I didn't mention earlier, is a guy in a wheelchair. He stays with Vicky, a girl who's trying to fuck him. And Scott stays because another girl, Terry, stays, and he's been trying to fuck her the whole movie. So, lots of teen horniness. Well, supposed to be teen horniness. We see someone walk by the porch and we get that ominous music. After everyone is left, Terry walks down to the lake and finally gives us some TNA as she goes skinny dipping. Back in the cabin, Mark and Jeff arm wrestle until Sandra pulls Jeff away to fuck. Mark is supposed to be this great arm wrestler. I guess he had to train one part of his body since he can't train his legs. Mark and Vicky play some old-ass electronic games while she basically tries to throw her pussy at him. We cut back to Terry, Scott, who, as I said, has been sexually harassing her the whole movie, steals her clothes. He runs away and throws her clothes back to her, everything except her shirt. He gets caught in a rope that dangles him upside down. He gives Terry her shirt and promises to stop, so she runs off to try and find something to cut him down. While he is waiting, Jason shows up and slits the motherfucker's throat with the back end of a machete. Good night. Terry grabs a knife and comes back to find Scott dead as fuck. She screams into the camera and we cut back to our group at the bar. Ginny tries to theorize about what Jason would be like if he were alive today, while Ted and Paul poke fun at her. Basically, this scene of her theories is here to explain how Jason is still alive. It kind of throws all logic, if you could even use that word to describe this movie, to see what would stick with the viewer. Paul eventually tells her Jason is just a legend out of frustration. Now, there has been no evidence in front of her that Jason is alive, so why she keeps insisting he is fucking beyond me. Back at Packinac, we get POV shots of Sandra and Jeff going to fuck, as well as Vicky and Mark's flirtation. We learn Mark is in a wheelchair because of a motorcycle accident. Vicky is quite delighted to learn that his cock still works. And this got me thinking, how is this camp wheelchair accessible? I don't see any ramps or lifts. What the fuck? Vicky and Mark have a quick makeout session, then she leaves to freshen up, which involves putting on a sweater, changing out of her black panties into brown ones, I guess so Mark can't see any of her skid marks. And finally, spraying perfume on her ratchet-ass pussy. She goes and grabs a hairbrush out of her car. Not sure why, because her hair is about to be all messed up anyway. And it starts to thunderstorm. Mark goes out to the porch because he thinks he hears something. And after a few seconds, he gets a backwards diagonal machete to the fucking face. His wheelchair goes backwards down off the porch and down the stairs that lead to the lake with him in it for the most spectacular kill in the series thus far. Jason leaves a machete in Mark's face, so I guess he has a souvenir from his time at Packinac. Thanks for the memories, Wheels. Now wheel yourself the fuck on out of this movie. Upstairs, Jeff and Sandra fuck. I should mention here that Sandra was supposed to have full frontal nudity in this scene, but either the actress lied about her age or the producers didn't realize it, but she was actually underage at the time. Good thing they found this out and didn't put child pornography on film forever and ever. Not that I'm sure that once word got out or leaked, that scene would have been cut from the DVD and Blu-ray releases and all subsequent releases, but still, that would have been bad news bears if they had an underage girl with full frontal nudity. Jason enters the cabin and picks the spear Ted used for the prank the night before up and heads upstairs. Jeff is on top when Jason enters and he shoves the spear right through both of them. Good fucking riddance to the both of you. This scene has been accused of copying from Mario Baba's Twitch of the Death Nerve, which definitely looks like it. Twitch of the Death Nerve is an Italian horror film, and I've never seen it, but I've seen clips of it, and it's something. It is something. Jimmy and Paul leave the bar while Ted stays behind and inquires about some after-hours places. We don't see Ted again, and I am pissed that we are deprived of seeing this fucking tool murdered, because if anyone deserved to be murdered in this movie, it is Ted. Vicky looks for Mark in the main cabin. He's dead, bitch. Anyway, she goes into Jeff and Sandra's room, and when she pulls the blanket, Jason pops out and scares her. Now, this is our first good look at Jason, and in this movie, most Friday the 13th franchise aficionados know that in the first movie it was his mother that did the killing, and in the second movie Jason wore like a pillowcase type thing over his head. He's got overalls and shit on. He looks like Farmer Brown. That kind of has me wondering, where did Jason get his clothes? What the fuck? Well, anyway, instead of this bitch running away like a normal person, she backs up to the wall and says, stop, until Jason kills her. You deserved it for being a fucking idiot. Ginny and Paul return to find the place a wreck. Ginny goes upstairs and yells for Paul after finding a blood-soaked bed. The lights go out, and Paul tries to fix the fuse. The fuse is in, like, the main room of the the main cabin. Jason pops out with the spear and misses Paul wildly. They have a scuffle on the floor until Jason stands up, evidently being the victor. Ginny locks herself in the bathroom, jokes on her because Jason bursts through the window. She runs out of there and into the kitchen where she arms herself with a knife. Jason breaks through the door with a pitchfork. Not sure where the fuck he got that at. And Ginny jumps out the window and runs to her car. She tries to start it, but it won't start, because it's a piece of shit, you see. Jason is outside the car window, and then he disappears. Jason jumped on the roof and tore the fabric, because it's a drop top, and he tears the fabric with his pitchfork. He puts his hand down to unlock the door, and Ginny kicks it open and knocks him down. A chase and some hide-and-seek ensue. At one point in this whole running around, Ginny hides in front of a car. I don't know why she didn't try to find keys or something. And I believe that they had established there were only two cars that they were taking to town, and neither of them were Paul's. Like, we see three cars this whole movie. Jenny's car, the truck Jeff and Sandra and Ted arrive in, and this car Jenny hides. There's probably 15, 20 kids, you know, when they're all there during the training scenes and the get-to-know-you scenes, so I guess they got dropped off. I don't fucking know. Anyway, they run through the woods for a bit. Jenny hides under a bed in a cabin. Jason enters said cabin and looks around. Jenny sees a rat under the bed, and she pisses herself. We see a puddle of piss come from under the bed, which makes no sense because she's wearing clothes. So if she were to wet herself, you would figure it would just be in her crotchal area. But no, apparently it runs down her pants and converges in a little puddle right outside of the bed. Makes no sense. Apparently Jason saw the piss because he hit on top of the bed and tries to get Jenny with the pitchfork whenever she rolls out. But Jason misses like an idiot. She backs him up with a chainsaw and busts a chair over him, seemingly knocking him out. She runs through the woods again and comes upon his shack. Now, despite the appearance of this place, and, you know, being in the middle of fucking woods, she goes on in looking for help like normal people live here. She is disturbed to find Mrs. Voorhees' head in the middle of a table, along with her sweater that she wore in the first one. She tries to think fast as Jason is breaking down his door. She comes up with a plan to put Mrs. Voorhees' nasty-ass sweater on and intimate her. Here, Jason does burst through, and here, while she talks to Jason like she is his mother, we get cuts of Betsy Palmer's face and Jenny's. This is Betsy's little cameo. She gets Jason to kneel down and goes to strike him with a machete, but Jason is actually too smart for that shit as he spots his mother's decapitated head behind Jenny and he raises his pickaxe he got from out his ass, apparently, to block the shot. She was going to kill him with the machete, and while they were filming this scene, the actress accidentally hit the guy playing Jason in the hand for real and sent him to the hospital. Lucky for her, Paul comes in and tussles with Jason to save her ass. Jenny picks up the machete during this and plunges it into Jason just as he is about to kill Paul. Jenny pulls the sack off his head and sees his face. Even though it is off screen, we can understand that he is one ugly motherfucker. They make it back to camp and into their cabin. As they have a moment, they hear something scratching at the door. Jenny arms herself with a pitchfork as Paul goes to open it, and they are relieved to find it's Muffin, the dog missing for half the movie we assumed was dead. Just as everything seems all right, Jason breaks through the window and grabs Jenny. We flash cut to the next morning with Jenny being loaded into an ambulance asking for Paul. We never find out what happened to him, and this remains a mystery of the franchise to this day. The ambulance leaves, and we focus on Mrs. Voorhees' head as spooky music starts up and the credits roll. The positives: good score, new cool kills, smart final girl, and a pretty likable cast for the most part. The negatives are, basically, it's the same movie over again without the whodunit aspect. Lots of what feels like filler in this movie, even more so than the first one, with lots of extended lulls between the action. And the ending is just fucked. Because Jenny and Paul make it back. Does Jason really bust through the window and grab her? And what happens to Paul? They try to explain this ending as a dream sequence or a nightmare sequence or something. They don't try to explain that in the next movie, but like fans and even maybe some of the people who worked on the movies try to explain this as a dream sequence because the Jason we see here has long brown hair and he looks nothing like the Jason in part three. And we do get to see extended scenes of Jason without his mask in part three. In part three, is supposed to take place one day after this one. So it can't really hold that against this movie because this came before part three, so they actually fucked everything up after that. But still, the way Jason looks is kind of ridiculous. But I don't know, in trying to explain that whole thing as a dream sequence, it just doesn't fucking work for me. And that's something that we'll find in the Friday franchises is with lots of things that don't make sense, they just try to explain them as dream sequences. And if it's all a dream sequence, then nothing means anything, but we'll get into that as we go along. But overall, this movie is a good entry into the series and is good at establishing Jason as the killer. Even if it makes no fucking sense how and why he survived, why wouldn't he just find his mother? And how could he live in the woods with no one finding him? Where did he get his fucking clothes? How's he pretty well dressed as Farmer fucking Burns here with no money, no mother, no nothing, no friends, no nothing? But no one watches a slash movie and considers silly things like logic or common sense. I give it a thumbs up though for the most part. I find it enjoyable, even the ridiculous bits, but I think it's a pretty decent movie. Join me next week as we take a look at Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D and see if this is a worthy entry into the storied 80s franchise. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter and like on Facebook.